From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Dr. Anandi Narasimhan talks about how to identify childhood anxiety and depression in the latest installment of our Road to Health series, and award-winning writer Sherman Alexie reflects on his complicated relationship with his mother as revealed in his new book, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. But first, the shooting of Republican members of Congress at a baseball practice session has led to calls for unity on both sides of the aisle and from President Trump. While it's true that the increasingly toxic nature of our nation's politics has created deep divisions, are there other factors that could have inspired someone to perpetrate an act of violence like this? Peter Bergen is a journalist and a national security analyst for CNN. His latest book is called United States of Jihad, Who Are America's Homegrown Terrorists, and How Do We Stop Them? It is now out in paperback. Peter, good to have you back on this program.
Thank you for having me back.
Let me jump right in. Who are America's homegrown terrorists? And moreover, why is it that we never talk about them versus the other guys?
Well, you know, I mean, 9/11 was one of the hinge events of American history. And of course, it was through 19 Arab foreign terrorists. And so I think the framing of the problem has mostly been, this is a problem of people coming into the country. President Donald Trump, you know, talks about refugees, talks about banning travel. But in fact, the problem now is really Americans overwhelmingly. All the lethal terrorist attacks in the United States since 9/11 have been conducted by American citizens or American legal residents. So it's a domestic problem. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, then you have also right-wing terrorists. You have, we have just had recently, you know, in Alexandria, Virginia, somebody who appears to have conducted a left-wing terrorist attack and critically wounded the House Majority Whip. So, you know, terrorism comes in lots of forms. But it is a domestic problem. Our defenses now for a foreign terrorist organization trying to attack the United States are very high.
Is that a mistake? And I shouldn't, maybe mistake is the wrong word, but I'll be taking our eye off the ball.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, is keenly aware that the problem is a domestic problem. And the FBI, you can certainly make the argument, I make it in partly in this book, that, you know, they have a lot of sting operations. Some of these look a little like entrapment, even though as a legal matter, entrapment has never been successfully argued as a defense. You know, the FBI does, you know, have a pretty aggressive effort to go after people that they think are radicalizing, and you know, understandably, that's their job. And if an attack happens, you know, it's the FBI or the NYPD who are often the people saying, you know, if they get some criticism for not stopping the attack, so it's understandable. But yeah, I mean, the big difference on 9/11, you know, the gate was open. We've made it very hard for Al Qaeda, for ISIS, the organizations to send people to the United States and do an attack. But what we can't stop the internet. Mm-hmm. And the whole, you know, this whole question about the travel ban, I think is a solution to a problem that doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. The problem is people radicalizing in their bedrooms with what they see online. And that, by the way, the FBI has 1,000 investigations in all 50 states. The people who are being attracted by this ideology, you know, they can be young kids in Chicago, they can be a white female in Denver, Colorado, age 19. They can be an African-American guy who was a military veteran in Ohio. You know, there is no real, you know, ISIS doesn't care, you know, what your background is. And there are enough, you know, people sitting around who may be disaffected for the ISIS propaganda to be successful.
So if this is a homegrown problem, then why have we wasted, to my mind at least, so much time going back and forth about this travel ban? Why is that Donald Trump's solution?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for the Trump administration, but I think, you know, clearly it was a campaign promise. And the worst thing in life is to believe your own propaganda. And I think that the Trump administration came to believe what they were saying, which is this is a refugee problem. There are very few refugees involved in this. And, you know, of the 400 plus cases that I looked at with my research team since 9/11, maybe a dozen cases involve refugees. None of them involve lethal attacks. So it's kind of a red herring. But the point is, it was a campaign promise, and this is not a guy who wants to back down from promises. And obviously, you know, multiple courts have said there are constitutional problems. But I would add to that, there is an effectiveness problem, because the countries, the six countries that are where the travel ban might be imposed temporarily, none of those citizens of those countries have conducted a lethal terrorist attack in the United States. So it's a solution in search of a problem that doesn't really exist. And the real issue is, how do you get people who are radicalizing to not take the next step, which is to kind of commit a violent act? And that's very hard, because until we have a machine that can read people's souls, you know, There's nothing illegal with me being a radical, right, mm-hmm. and having militant ideas in this country. Mm-hmm. But there is, you know, the question is, like, at what point do I start becoming violent? And that, you know, that can be a pretty quick process.
Yeah. Why can't this issue of homegrown terrorism get the kind of traction that it gets in your text? Why can't we get that in our public discourse?
Well, I mean, I think we're beginning to get it because, you know, we had the attack not far from this studio in San Bernardino. Mm-hmm. One of the attackers was born in Chicago. His wife was born in Pakistan, but she was a legal permanent resident. You know, they killed 14 people. Omar Mateen was born in Queens, New York. I mean, I think people are beginning to realize, look, it's not a problem of the scope, of the scale that we see in the United Kingdom or in France, but it is a problem. I mean, and it also, what's interesting to me is, in quite a number of these cases, people have legally bought semi-automatic weapons, despite the fact that they have previously come to the attention of the FBI. One thing that I find very kind of surprising is, why can't we have, if you're on the no-fly list, why can you buy a semi-automatic weapon mm-hmm. legally? And that makes no sense. If you're too dangerous to fly, why is it okay for you to buy a semi-automatic weapon? And Representative Peter King, who is a Republican from mm-hmm. New York, who I don't always agree with, he has had legislation for the past decade, which almost got passed after Orlando, which said basically, if you're on the no-fly list, you can't buy a semi-automatic weapon. Mm-hmm. But that even after Orlando, that couldn't pass. So we're in a kind of strange situation where one of the most common sense measures we could do, it wouldn't solve the problem completely, is to prevent people who have come to the attention of the FBI or are on the no-fly list from not buying a semi-automatic weapon.
You said it won't pass. I'll take it a step further. It won't pass, as you well know, because the NRA is opposed to it, and they're in the
right.
pockets of so many members of Congress, and that's why it won't pass.
Exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, the NRA, I mean, this is an example of their, you know, total absolutism. I mean, because
sure.
it, like, there isn't a large majority of Americans, when you ask them the question, does it make sense if you're on the no-fly list that you can buy a semi-automatic weapon, would say, that makes no sense. But, you know, we're at a place in our politics where, you know, kind of common sense measures won't pass.
Yeah. How disturbed were you, and maybe you weren't at all, but how disturbed were you when we saw this most recent attack that injured, of course, the majority whip, Steve Scalise?
Yeah.
This was a guy, Mr. Hodgkinson, as I recall his name, who had been a Bernie Sanders supporter.
Yep.
Bernie Sanders came out almost immediately and denounced this and decried this and said that violence has no place in our society. And yet it didn't stop people from playing politics with this, because the guy shows up at a baseball game and says, is this the Republicans' baseball game? They said, yes, it is. And the fire and the student begins. I'm only asking how disturbing that is, because if it can happen on both sides of, if it can happen in either direction, and every time it happens one way or the other, we play politics with it, then we don't get to the solving the problem.
Well, I mean, we live in a polarized political environment, so it's not surprising. But I mean, I think what is interesting is, here is the first case of a really, you know, relatively serious leftist terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen that for, you know, in the 70s, we saw a lot of that with the Weather Underground, which launched tons of bombings and assassination attempts. So, I mean, you know, the question is, this is kind of canary in the mine. Will we see other leftist, because
they've mostly been rightist attacks.
They've been mostly, the lethal attacks have been neo-Nazis, far right, you know, that's been fairly constant since 9/11.
Right.
They don't necessarily kill a lot of people, but it's been fairly constant.
Now you get a left one,
Now we have a left one. So on the left, you know, there was environmental activists, and there were animal rights groups, sort of more militant ones, but they were really involved in property damage. But now we have an example of a leftist terrorist who was, you know, clearly intended to kill people and critically wounded the House Majority Whip. So the question is that a canary in the mine, or is that a one-off? And yeah, I don't know the answer, but I don't think it's impossible that we will see other kinds of examples like this.
You don't think it's impossible?
I don't think it's impossible at all.
So if law enforcement can't track this, let alone stop this, what are we to do?
Well, they can track, they do a pretty good job, but they, you know, by the law of averages, the people are going to get through. I mean, most of the people who carry out these attacks have come to the attention of law enforcement. Hodgkinson, the guy who carried out the attack in Alexandria, Virginia, he had come to the attention of law enforcement authorities because there was a fairly serious allegation of domestic abuse. In the end, the charges were dismissed. But the point is, most of these people usually have some brush with the law of one kind or another. Domestic abuse, the FBI suddenly, you know, interviews them. But, you know, the FBI can't keep a case open forever. We live in a, you know, open society, free society. So, I mean, the sad fact is these things will continue. I do think the FBI and DHS and other parts of the government have got a reasonably good handle on this. You know, if we'd had this discussion in 2002 and I said to you, in the next decade and a half, about 100 Americans would be killed by jihadi terrorists in the next decade and a half. That would have seemed like a crazy prediction in 2002. We were concerned about another 9/11, right? If you think so, we have managed and contained that, we, the United States. But we cannot wipe it out. That's just an impossible task. It's just, that's not possible.
Do the American people have any agency in this conversation?
I think they do, because if you're radicalized or I'm radicalized, who are the people who are going to notice? Mm-hmm. It's going to be our peers and our family members. And so that's the people who, whether it's jihadist militants or far right people.
Or far left. Yeah.
Peers and family members have the most information. The people who have the least information are strangers, and they're the people most likely to drop a dime. So they produce a lot of false positives. So peers and family members, peers in particular, are reluctant to say something when they see something. But the fact is, they have the most useful information.
I was about to ask, what does that turn us into, though?
Well, that's exactly right. So then this is very difficult. Let's say if I'm a family member and I see one of my family members radicalizing, I have a very difficult choice. I can say, go to the FBI or some organization. But that family member could spend up to 20 years in prison if they are attempting to join ISIS. On the other hand, if I say nothing and they go to the airport and they go to Syria, they almost certainly will die in the Syrian civil war. So it's a very, very difficult question for families. And I think the FBI, to its credit, is now also going in to talk to people. There was a woman called Shannon Connolly in Denver, age 19. The FBI talked to her four times about, don't join ISIS. Why don't you just join a Syrian charity? You'll do more for Syria that way. But she ignored them. She got to try to get on a flight to go to Syria to join ISIS. So there are ways which don't always work about where you try and try and reason with somebody, because a lot of these are kids. I mean, they're 19-year-old kids.
Mm. Peter Bergen, good to have you on.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. A child's mental health is one of the most important factors in their development. Unfortunately, conditions like anxiety and depression have become more common in today's high-tech world. They can interfere with their daily lives and make learning a serious challenge. Adolescent psychiatrist Dr. Anandi Narasimhan joins us now to talk about how to identify and treat these conditions as part of our Road to Health series.
Doc, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Before I get into the specific symptoms and how to treat those symptoms, you're the physician, not me, but it just seems to me, with all the anger and all the anxiety in the world, just pick up, turn on your television, get in the car, turn on the radio, pick up your phone. It's like we're just being inundated with news and information that causes anxiety, that causes anger. And I suspect, if adults feel that, then children must feel that as well.
Absolutely. There's this trickle-down effect. And when I talk to parents, I always talk about role modeling. So if a parent's anxious or if they're irritable, a lot of times we'll see the same symptoms in the children as well. So yes, absolutely, I think the way adults talk, the way adults communicate, whether it's virtually or in person, absolutely does have an effect on young people, because they're listening.
At this particular moment, though, in this country, indeed around the world, I don't need to run through the news headlines, you see the same thing I see. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing children who are being more acutely impacted by this because of this moment that we find ourselves in?
That's complex and interesting. I do hear conversations from young people asking me about the future, about all the uncertainty, like what's going to happen to them, what's going to even happen to their health care. Really young children wanting to know the answers to these questions. So they are hearing and they are listening and they are worried about what may happen to their parents, their families, even with immigration. I'll have a lot of young children ask me what's going to happen with their families. Are they going to be separated from their parents? So, yes, I think the current environment does affect the dialogue that my patients, these young children, are having with me.
Does that mean that since your earlier point was that children oftentimes mirror what you see in adults, does that mean that adults shouldn't have these kinds of conversations in front of their kids?
Well, I think that children can listen in numerous ways. They can even sense anxiety in the parents. So if the parent's very anxious about their financial situation or if they've been laid off from their job, the child's gonna know. So I don't always encourage secrets from children, but there are certain adult themes that don't need to be discussed with children, or you know, arguments don't need to be had in front of children. So it depends on the topic. And it depends on how that child's being affected by that particular topic or an environmental change, or if there's going to be some major life change in a family, such as a separation, you know, a child should know about it and they should be prepared for it. But the issue is not necessarily the conflict itself, but how it's handled.
What kind of signs should parents be looking for if or when their children are being affected in these ways?
There can be numerous signs that a parent can see, you know, when their child is struggling with anxiety or mood changes. One of the things to remember is that children can't express themselves very well because they're at a developmental stage where they're not able to use their words, like to say, I'm really scared, or I'm afraid, or I'm feeling very nervous. So they don't say these things. So instead, what we'll see is sometimes they're not doing very well in school, or they're acting out at school, or they're getting into fights. Or they're not sleeping well at night, or not eating well. So there'll be different kinds of scenarios. And so my role is really cool in that I'm like a detective when I talk to these children. And the parent may say, well, you know, he's not doing well in school, she's not sleeping well, she won't separate from me, and I don't know what this stuff means. And then I'll talk to the child and, you know, I'll get a little bit more of why this might be happening.
And when you discover through your detective work what's ailing or bothering the child, what do you do? What happens next? Or what's a parent to do at that point?
So a lot of what I do initially is what we call psychoeducation in mental health. That means I'll give the parent information. I'll even talk to the child. So it's first informing them what I think is going on. I might, you know, say, I think your child's really anxious. A lot of times a child comes to me because there's been some major life stress in the family and the child's reacting to it. I mean, I see homeless families, so some of these children, you know, they are in transitional housings or they're in hotels and that's affecting them. So they're engaging in other behaviors. So I'll explain this to the parent, like, hey, the reason why this is happening is because your child's having anxiety or stress due to this. And how do we deal with it? So one of the things I might do is just simply logistics, allocation of resources, or calling up the case manager and saying, hey, can you help this family with housing? Or, I think this child's parent is really anxious. Can we help the parent get some treatment? Because a lot of times you treat the parent, you're also treating the child. The child automatically gets better when you treat the parent. So that's, you know, what I start out doing. And then we'll talk about other forms of treatment or where to go from there.
How much of what kids are feeling these days in terms of anxiousness has to do with the environments in which they live? I don't mean just inside the home with parents who are anxious. I mean literally environmental factors.
A lot, a lot. A lot of problems are school-based. Bullying, it's not new, but it continues to be a big problem. And now we have a different platform of bullying, which is the digital world with all the technological advances. So, you know, you'll see children who don't want to go to school and they won't say why, and they're afraid that if they do out their bullies, that it's going to come back to them worse. Mm-hmm. So that's still a big issue. Other environmental factors are just what's going on at home, what's going on in their neighborhood. Some of my patients come from unsafe neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and then they're, you know, experiencing these things, and that's causing them to be anxious. So there's all sorts of environmental influences that that affects a child's mental health.
Mm-hmm. When you see these children, what gives you hope that you can address the concerns that so many kids increasingly are having these days?
You know, I think the beauty of what I do is that when you catch things early, or mm-hmm. when you identify problems early, sometimes the interventions are just small interventions, but they have an enormous effect long term. You can really alter the trajectory of these children's life by early intervention. So the best form of mental health treatment is early mental health treatment. And there's also, now we're moving into preventive mental health. Mm-hmm. You don't want children to have more anxiety in the future, or depression or suicidal thoughts in the future. So there are ways and there are treatments that are effective in preventing those things. So that gives me a lot of hope. Yeah. And resilience. I mean, children by nature are resilient, yeah. and their brains are still developing. So there's a lot that you can do to make sure that the brain is developing in a positive way.
Thank you for your work. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Novelist and poet Sherman Alexie. He's published more than 24 works. His latest is a memoir called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. It's a collage of essays and poems about his childhood on the Spokane Indian Reservation and his complicated relationship with his mother. Sherman, good to have you on the program.
Thank you,
Tavis. When I saw, I'm curious as to how you felt when you saw the cover art, but when I saw it, that broken frame, the photo in the center, and that title, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Before I even got into this thing, it hit me.
It made me cry the first time I saw the cover art. Yeah. And it's exactly the first draft of the cover art. Yeah. It was so perfect. And it made me cry. And that is not me on the cover with my mother. That is my big sister. And the broken frame and two women who died. My big sister died in a house fire. My mm-hmm. mother died in July of 2015 15, of cancer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it is a photo of a mother and daughter and who are gone. And the loss, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which is a Dusty Springfield song, mm-hmm. One of the sadder songs ever recorded. And so the entire holistic, it just encapsulates all my grief in one image.
Why did you go with that title?
You know, I searched and searched and searched, and then I looked up the top 10 hits of my birth year, 1966. Uh-huh. And You Don't Have to Say You Love Me was number 2. And as soon as I read it on the list, I remember hearing it from my youth, and my mom sang a lot. Yeah. So my mom was always singing the top 40 songs. So I remember her singing You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. And in fact, as soon as I titled that, then I started remembering other songs she used to sing that I include in the book. You know, she sang I'm Not Lisa by Jesse mm-hmm. Coulter. She sang a lot of Linda Ronstadt. She mm-hmm. sang Dolly Parton. So the idea of naming this book after a pop song just seemed perfect.
Yeah. There's a piece on page 113, I think. A piece that I want you to read because I think it probably encapsulates pretty nicely what this story is that you tell in the book. But the piece is called Utensil, and I wonder if you'll read it for me.
Utensil. While feasting on venison stew after we buried my mother, I recognized my spoon and realized my family had been using it for at least 42 years. How does one commemorate the ordinary? I thanked the spoon for being a spoon and finished my stew. How does one get through a difficult time? How does the son properly mourn his mother? It helps to run the errands to get shit done. I washed that spoon, dried it, and put it back in the drawer. But I did it consciously, paying attention to my hands, my wrists, and the feel of steel against my fingertips. Then my wife drove us back home to Seattle, where I wrote this poem about ordinary grief. Thank you, poem, for being a poem. Thank you, paper and ink, for being paper and ink. Thank you, desk, for being a desk. Thank you, mother, for being my mother. Thank you for your imperfect love. It almost worked. It mostly worked, or partly worked. It was almost enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me get myself together here. Why was your mother's love imperfect?
Like many Native American women now and in the past, she was a target for all sorts of violence and oppression and racism and misogyny. And I think the pain she endured growing up prevented her in some ways from being able to fully express her love, mm-hmm. from being able to fully trust the world. So I think in some ways she was not built to be a mother. Mm-hmm. It was more like blue-collar labor for her, I think. I think she had to concentrate. Mm-hmm. And the thing she ended up being, the thing she could do, was she was dependable. She was a worker. My father was a random alcoholic. My mother sobered up and became the breadwinner. She was the one who paid the bills. She was the one who bought the groceries. She was the one who kept the electricity on. So in a lot of ways, she ended up being my mother and my father. Mm-hmm. She ended up fulfilling every gender role inside of our family, and she did it without being very affectionate. I can remember her hugging me twice in my life. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to talk about a mother that way, of not having an affectionate mother, and I get very jealous when I meet people who have or have had affectionate mothers. I did not.
Mm. This is real sensitive territory. For you, because you wrote it, and for me, for different reasons. But I wonder whether or not you think your mother was... I don't want to color the question. Why do you think your mother was not affectionate? It wasn't intentional.
I think because of the abuse, because mm-hmm. she was sexually abused, because she was raped, I think it cut off a part of her emotional life. Mm-hmm. I think prevented her from fully expressing herself emotionally. I think her scar tissue was very deep.
Mm-hmm. Did your siblings feel the same way?
It's interesting, in writing the memoir, and as I was writing it, I was calling my sisters a lot, my brothers less so, but my sisters a lot, to fact check myself, to test our memories against each other. And in writing the memoir, I came to realize that my siblings were much better children than I was, and that my mother was a much better mother to them. And what I've come to realize is that my siblings, my brothers and sisters, are far more like my father, who was a very passive, gentle person, mm-hmm. and my mother was this arrogant, opinionated, domineering, aggressive, ambitious person, and I'm very much like her. And also, I think she was undiagnosed bipolar, and mm-hmm. I am diagnosed bipolar. So I think, as I say in the book, that we lived our lives on parallel roller coaster mm-hmm. tracks. So I think we were built to fight each other.
When you say that your siblings were better children, by that you mean what?
They were more affectionate. Mm-hmm. They stayed. They saw her more. They took care of her more. They were there for her. They were far more dependable mm-hmm. and far more of an everyday presence in her life than I was.
Is that an indictment against yourself?
I would call it that, yes.
Yeah.
One of the things in writing a memoir, I didn't want to come off as heroic. Mm-hmm. I wanted this memoir to be about the ways in which I failed my mother, as well as the ways in which I think she failed me. and I did fail her. You know, at some point, no matter how bad a mother she was to me as a child, at some point as an adult, I chose to be a bad son. I chose not to pursue forgiveness. I chose to keep my anger precious. And so in that way, I failed her.
By keeping your anger precious, you mean?
Holding on to it, mm-hmm. valuing it, making my anger toward her such a part of the way I lived in the world that I couldn't see any other alternative. I couldn't forgive. I couldn't forget. I couldn't let it go.
The obvious question, as you well know, is, well, what happened? What happened if you indicted yourself into your adulthood? What happened to make you even want to, much less sit down to write it, but to even want to dig into your past?
Well, my mother died in July 2015, mm-hmm. and poems just roared out of me, about 75 poems in about a month. And I'd never written about her. I'd only written fiction before. This is my first nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And I'd never written about her even in fictional form, not really. She was always absent from my work. I was mm-hmm. scared of her. I was scared of her magic and her power and her rage and her love. And when she died, it gave me permission to start thinking about her. And one of the amazing things I realized is I'd spent my whole career thinking my father was the primary engine behind my storytelling. He was the one who talked. He was the one who went on long drives with me and told me stories about his childhood. He was the one who gave me autobiography, and my mom didn't. But in writing the memoir, I realized that she, the artistic force, you know, she was one of the last fluent speakers of our tribal language. I mean, they're resurrecting it now, but she was one of the last old-time mm-hmm. speakers. She was a powwow dancer. She was a powwow person. She was traditional. She was one of the elders in the tribe. All this knowledge. She was the one who most directly connected to thousands and thousands of years of tribal traditions, storytelling traditions. Mm-hmm. And I never thought of her that way until after she was gone.
How much of your relationship, or lack thereof, with your mother had to do with what you referenced a moment ago, Sherman, and that is your fear of her, your being scared of her?
Oh, her judgment, not being good enough, not being loved enough, not loving her enough. I never felt like I measured up to her. And the thing is, because of her, what I think was her bipolar disorder, she was completely emotionally unpredictable. So she could rage at you for no reason. She could be tender. She would work all night on quilts to make money so we'd have food to eat. So she was incredibly dedicated to one thing at a time or to everything at a time. And you could never get a handle on her. And it was just easier to run away from her than it was to be in her presence.
I don't know that I discovered this going through the text, going through the book. But how much of the difference you mentioned your sisters and brothers, but how much of the difference in the relationship between you and your mom had to do with your gender? I'm just trying to get at you. Know what I'm getting at here? Oh. Your sisters had a different rapport with your mother,
and my brothers had a different.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I had a really tough time in writing this book and being honest about my mother. I was very worried that it would come off as being misogynistic, mm-hmm. that it would become us of a son being mad at a woman, at mm-hmm. a man being mad at a woman. Mm-hmm. So I was very concerned about that. But I think it was less about gender and more about that we shared a mental illness. I think it ends up being that she and I were the most alike. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we fought so often. I've always thought of myself as being my father's son. Mm-hmm. But one of the working titles of this memoir was my mother's son. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I've discovered that I am, that she is my primary parent.
If your mother was undiagnosed bipolar, as you believe she was, and you've already acknowledged that you are diagnosed
yes.
bipolar, I don't know that there's a real answer to this question. I'm going to ask it anyway, mm-hmm. which is, if you could go back and change anything about that relationship, do you know what that would be?
I write about it in the book. You know, one of the things I really realized, I don't think my mother was ever adored.
Yeah.
You know, and being a Native woman, mm-hmm. from her generation, any generation, nobody adored her. And I think if somebody had adored her, if there had been people there to adore her, that she could have been somebody incredible, amazing. She had all these gifts and talents and ambitions. And I think if somebody had been there to protect her, if somebody had been there to protect her dreams, to protect her soul and her heart, I think she would have been magnificent.
I say this respectfully, but that's a lot of baggage to carry through life, as yes. if you didn't already know that. That's a lot of luggage, Sherman.
Yes.
When, where, how did you come to believe, accept, or become courageous enough to know, or to convince yourself that with all that baggage, you could still be a worthy partner in a relationship?
I'm still working on that. You'd have to ask my wife. Yeah, sure. But I've been married for 24 years. Yeah. I've been married for almost half my life. So I think I'm doing okay.
Something's working. But that might, I mean, I don't know. You tell me, was that ever intimidating?
Yes. Yeah. I'm married to an indigenous woman. Yeah. I married a Native American woman. We have two sons, and often, I mean, my wife is also an incredibly powerful, magnetic, charismatic person, and at times she scares me and intimidates me in similar ways. Mm-hmm. But in writing this book, and writing about my relationship with my wife and meeting her and sharing this journey with her, with my mother's death and with examining my mother's death, I think we've become closer. Mm-hmm. And she read... I didn't let her read the book until I was done. Mm-hmm. And she read it. And the thing she said is, the first thing she said is, I feel cherished. Mm. And I thought, well, good, because you are.
Mm. Maybe you said more than that. You don't have to say any more if that's all you want to say. But it seems to me that if your wife, given all that you've described to us about your mother and what she did not feel, what she did not receive, if your wife reads your manuscript and she says nothing else other than I feel cherished, that's got to feel like, that's powerful. That's arresting. I mean, it's like.
My most important audience.
Yeah.
My most important reader, the most important person in my life. And I wrote something that honors her, and she feels honored. Yeah. So, yes.
So my point is, there's obviously one less Native woman who was made to feel the way your mother felt.
I hope so, yes. Yeah, yeah. And I think my sisters as well, little sisters, they're twins, I think. I'm loving the reviews, and people talk about how funny and smart mm-hmm. and witty they are in the book and how they challenge me mm-hmm. and they contradict me and they mock me. Mm-hmm. I think their power comes through in the book as well, my amazing sisters. And Shelley Boyd, yeah. Who was the wife of one of my mm-hmm. best friends who died, and she's learning the language and became very close to my mother. And I think her power and her efforts to speak Salish again and to establish a school to teach younger people to speak our tribal languages again. So I think the power of women is in the book.
Yeah. Speaking of the power of women, we talked about one of those women on the front of the book, your mother.
Yes.
Tell me about the other.
My big sister, mm-hmm. Mary, my mm-hmm. half-sister, who was this, you know, as I say in the book, my memories of her are of this incredibly romantic figure. I mean, she ran away to Haight Ashbury in the 70s and got pregnant. And she's incredibly beautiful like my mother and smart and charming. And I didn't know then that romantic heroes are often aimless nomads in disguise. And my sister died in a drunken house fire with her husband when I was 14. So it was one of the major deaths in my life, one of the major griefs. And she was the first person who ever told me I could be a writer. I had written a little short story in fourth grade, a Halloween story. And she read it, and it scared her, she said.
Mm-hmm. Mission accomplished.
Yes.
If a Halloween story scares you, did your job.
Yeah. You know, and at that point, as a poor reservation Indian kid, the idea of becoming a writer, the idea of becoming anything seemed like going to the moon or going to Mars. Mm-hmm. So the fact that my sister said that to me all those years ago resonated. And she died the year I left the reservation school to go to the white high school on the border. Mm-hmm. I lost 8 people in 2 years. a close relative. So it felt like a curse, like me leaving had caused it to happen. Of course, that's a narcissistic way of looking at it. But it's hard not to look at it that way when you're 14 and 15 years old.
I'm not so sure that's narcissistic. I'm reminded now of the late, great Maya Angelou.
Yeah.
And I know why the cage bird sings. And you know her story, that she went quiet because she thought her voice had killed the man who had raped her. And I didn't see that as narcissism any more than I see this as narcissism. I don't see it that way at all. But speaking of your leaving to go to the white high school outside the reservation, for those of us who are fans of your work and know indeed some of the trouble you've gotten into with people, some schools won't let your book be read.
Yes.
Your part-time Indian notion.
Yes.
Has got you in some hot water here and there. But I wonder how much of this relationship with your mom, or lack thereof, the stories you tell in this beautiful book, how much of that influenced your decision to get off the reservation, and whether or not revisiting that childhood has made you rethink a decision, obviously, that you can't change at this point. But have you rethought that decision?
Well, my mom always, you know, half in admiration and half insultingly, always said I was born with a suitcase in my hand, that I was always leaving. Mm-hmm. And my sisters, during the course of writing this book, said that to me in various ways, too, that they always knew I was leaving. So I think I was born to leave. Mm-hmm. And I've lived in the city now for 25 years, and I realized that a lot of my sadness as a kid certainly had a lot to do with poverty and alcohol addiction and my mental illnesses and all the brain surgeries I had. But I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was born to live in the city. We often think of Native Americans as being born to live, you know, in the wilderness, in the forests, in the deserts, closely connected to nature. But I think I was born to live in crowds. I'm happiest in crowds.
Can you leave your people without leaving your people? And when you leave your people, can they accept that you're not leaving your people?
When you come from a very specific tribe like I do, I think you do leave your people. And then I think you spend the rest of your life reclaiming pieces of what you left behind. And I think every one of my books is an effort to reclaim something I left behind. And I think this book is an effort to reclaim my mother.
As you reclaim your mother, what do you intend to do with her?
I'm just starting that ceremony. Mm-hmm. I realized writing the book was the first half of this, and now going out into the world with it, talking to you, talking to audiences, having people read it, responding and thinking, and hearing other people's stories about their relationship with their mothers, I think that's where I'll be carrying her. Mm-hmm. Into all these other stories I'm going to hear.
We talked a little bit, Sherman, about about how your life has impacted your relationship with your wife. We talked a bit about that. I'm curious to know how it's impacted your choices as a parent. Based upon your backstory, what kind of parent did you want to be? And have you become that, or are you becoming the kind of parent you wanted to be?
Well, we have two sons. You can't predict, you know, who you're going to have. We have two sons, so I certainly wanted to raise them to be very respectful of women, to be very respectful of Native women in particular, and I think we've done that. I wanted kindness above all else, kindness. I wanted to have kind men, and I think my wife and I have done a good job.
So that's not oxymoronic,
no.
To be kind and a male.
Exactly.
Okay.
Kind men. Yeah. Kindness overall.
Yeah. Yeah. All these years later, I've spent some time on reservations here or there for interviews and other events. It was a Standing Rock last year, as a matter of fact. What's your sense of how much better, worse, the same women today are treated on the reservation?
You know, Native American women, socially speaking, deal with more violence, more poverty, more social problems than any other group of people in the United States and Canada. Mm-hmm. They are the primary targets of so much hatred and so much animosity within and from inside and outside the communities. And that has gotten better somewhat, at least there's more voices talking about it, but it still persists. In fact, in Canada, you know, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of Indigenous women who've gone missing. And you know, every day I see on the internet somebody else has gone missing. Mm-hmm. So it continues to be an epic problem for Indigenous women, and we need to continue to speak about it, to use our voices, to promote the voices of Indigenous women and their stories and their power, and to celebrate and honor them, and to listen to Indigenous women.
It's a powerful book. It's called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. It's a memoir by the brilliant Sherman Alexie, winner of the National Book Award. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing, or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.